From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, manifestations and luck. Here's what's happening. A Florida man is facing up to 40 years in prison for plotting to sink Target's stock price by placing bombs on the shelves of various stores along the East Coast. The 40-year-old man, Mark Barnett from Ocala, was found guilty of attempted arson and possession and making of unregistered destructive devices. Meanwhile, hundreds of gun owners in Florida have been ordered to give up their guns under a new law that took effect after the deadly Parkland shooting in February. The risk protection order signed by the Florida governor just 3 weeks after a gunman killed 17 people at the school aims to temporarily remove weapons from gun owners who had been deemed by a judge to possibly be a threat to themselves or others. A gun rights group that has posted plans for 3D guns blocked downloads from its own website after a federal judge sided with states that argue the postings could help criminals and terrorists manufacture such weapons. North Korea appears to be building, as we reported yesterday, new ballistic missiles despite recent warnings and ties with the Trump administration and pledges to get rid of their nukes. Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi on this one. Jerry, what's happening in North Korea?
Well, clearly, George, there are reports that are credible that North Korea is building at least two ICBMs in a facility that built ICBMs that could reach the United States. So it's an alarming report. Washington Post was the first to report it on Monday. The State Department, as recently as 3 hours ago, is still saying they're predicting North Korean denuclearization, and they believe it's going to take a period of time, that these missiles were already under construction and are being completed. And I expect, George, it's going to be a bit of a start and stop. We just got the remains of Korean War POWs returned, which is a positive sign. And then now we see North Korea completing at least two ICBMs. That's a negative sign. I think we'll have a little bit of this start and stop for a while until we really determine if North Korea is serious or not.
Hey, what is Kim Jong-un's game plan here? Why would he be doing this? Is he trying to force us to try to come up with some deal with him? What's going on?
Well, always North Korea has been a kind of a bargaining country. They've always kind of engaged in these extortionist activities. And also, North Korea has a large military, which is not going to easily denuclearize. So I expect George is going to take some start and stops, and I don't doubt that President Trump could put three aircraft carrier task force groups off of North Korea's shores at any time he decides that this is not a serious effort. But I think at the moment the administration is going to be patient and work this through, and the State Department still seems positive that North Korea is on the track to denuclearization. It's got to be watched very carefully, George, and I think you're really right to bring it to everybody's attention, and we need to examine this almost day by day to see what North Korea is really doing.
And what is Jerry Corsi working on these days?
Well, we just launched a new website, CorsiNation.com, and I'm doing daily live chats on YouTube at 5 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern Time.
And you're all over Newsmax because they're sponsoring parts of our program, and they mention you all the time.
Well, my book, Killing the Deep State, was on the New York Times bestseller list for a month, and it's still selling very well. And that's a Newsmax publication.
You got it. Jerry, thanks. We'll talk to you later, Dr. Jerome Corsi. Cummins has agreed to recall about 500,000 medium and heavy-duty trucks produced between 2010 and 2015 to correct a faulty emissions control system that degrades and allows too much nitrogen oxide pollution, according to the EPA. Now, this is an interesting story. Consumer debt is at an all-time high. Should banks be worried? There's foreclosures, all kinds of problems. College graduates are forced to move into their parents' basements. Aging workers had their retirement plans upended. What's happening these days? Let's check in with registered investment advisor Michael Shedlock. Mish, what's happening with the economy? It feels good, but I'm not sure.
George, you summed it up right there. I don't even know why you need me here. The
because you're the expert.
GDP rose 4% or so, 4.1%. But it was on the backs of a tax cut. I give Trump credit for that because it did spur the economy, but it also spurred more debt and more borrowing. And I don't like that. And so while I can praise him for the tax cuts, I can pan him for his trade policy. The five Republican senators openly came out and objected to Trump's trade policy. That is actually what spurred this alleged agreement with the EU to back off and hold things for now. Trump really backed down. I think he needs to, and I think he needs to back down more. I'm not sure what game we're playing here, but I see a huge risk to the economy. I see a huge risk for the Republicans heading into the midterm elections. That's what the game is all about here now, George. And it's very hard to untangle this.
We're going to have to watch it. Mish, thank you so much. Mish's website, part of his blog that you can find on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Your social calendar might be taking the joy out of activities that are supposed to be fun or relaxing, according to an upcoming paper co-written by a professor who studies time management. The paper argues that when a leisure activity is planned rather than spontaneous, we enjoy it less. Oath Keepers. We're going to be talking about that organization and what it all means next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. The Florida sheriff who declined to arrest a man who invoked the Stand Your Ground law after shooting a man in a parking dispute said that he made the correct decision. We're going to get into that and so many other issues. Two special guests. Our first guest, Stuart Rhodes, is the founder and national president of Oath Keepers. He served as a U.S. Army paratrooper until disabled in a rough terrain parachuting accident. He's a former member of Congressman Ron Paul's Washington, D.C. staff, and he worked on both of Ron Paul's presidential campaigns. Stuart graduated from Yale Law School, where his paper, Solving the Puzzle of Enemy Combatant Status, won Yale's top prize for a paper on the Bill of Rights. Stuart has served as a volunteer firefighter, as a state-certified concealed carry firearms instructor, and has taught rape prevention and self-discipline and defense as a volunteer instructor in college and law school. Stuart, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
And thank you for serving, by the way, too. It's very important for us to really recognize you for what you did in Ron Paul. How's he doing? What's new with him?
He's doing pretty good. He's got his own educational homeschooling channel, and he just drives on with that. He thinks that education is the key. Always did, actually.
So we're going to talk a lot about Stand Your Ground, but tell us a little bit about Oath Keepers for a lot of people who don't know what that organization is.
Well, Oath Keepers is an association of military, police, and first responders, both current, serving, and retired. And we also allow in what we call associate members, so those who have not served in those capacities can still join because we're all in this together. So if you're a patriot, you're more than welcome to join. And we're actually running a membership special right now for the next 24 hours, just for your listeners, in fact.
All right, great. How do they find you? Just through your website, which we've got linked up at Coast to Coast?
You bet, oathkeepers.org.
Super. What do you think of this ruling, this judge basically saying, hey, wait a minute now, 3D printing of guns, we don't want that to happen. What do you think of that?
Well, you're not going to stop knowledge. I mean, you know, out here in Montana, I'm sure it's the same in where you live. You got guys that run machine shops and have been making things all their lives. They could make almost anything. What's unique about 3D printing is it takes the need to know of how to manufacture things out of the equation. You just buy a 3D printer and it does it for you. But you're never going to stop guys and be able to make homemade and you know, out in a garage or their shop, make firearms.
And so I would guess too, Stuart, that if a terrorist wants to sneak a plastic gun through a TSA screening system, they're going to be able to do that, aren't they?
Oh, sure. And any system you put in place for you know, stopping someone is going to be circumvented by a terrorist. But the cartridge itself will still be metallic. So I think it's a red herring. I think the people who are freaked out by it most are the anti-gunners who want to believe that someday they'll be able to completely ban, you know, evil weapons. And it's just not ever going to happen. You know, they'll come across the border with the drugs like everything else, or like I said, some guy can make it in his garage.
Now, when you started Oath Keepers, what did you see? What really hit you to
Katrina.
Get this organization going?
I would say Hurricane Katrina, when we saw, unfortunately, you know, law enforcement officers from all over the country brought to New Orleans to help, obeying a clearly unconstitutional order by the mayor, an anti-gunner, to confiscate guns from people who were just trying to protect themselves and their property. And perversely, in the middle of an emergency, when they need firearms, when there's a breakdown in law and order and a breakdown in the services, is exactly when you need to have the ability to defend yourself. So we saw that. It was quite a wake-up call to see so many law enforcement officers and also military personnel obeying unconstitutional orders.
You know, I always make this disclaimer, Stuart, that I'm a concealed weapons permit holder. I am a staunch Second Amendment rights advocate. And I hope that people, of course, continue to push for the Constitution. I just don't know. Is that Second Amendment, in your opinion, being whittled away?
Well, it's like Daniel Greenfield noted not too long ago, one half of the country, we consider it a fundamental human right, extension of, obviously, the first rule of nature is self-preservation, and it's part of our culture. It's not going anywhere. But then you have the other half of the country, you know, the leftists who grew up in big cities like New York, where they've never had a right to bear arms, recognized by their city, and they think it's abhorrent. So you have this strange, you know, split in the United States. And I don't see how you can reconcile that. One half of the country believes it's evil, the other half believes it's a good. What do you do?
Exactly. In about 20 minutes, Greg McWhorter joins us, a law enforcement officer who is one of your board of directors for Oath Keepers, to get his perspective on some of these issues we're talking about. Stand Your Ground. Let's talk a little bit about that. Again, explain what that is.
Well, what that is simply you don't have to retreat and run away or run out of your own home before you can avail yourself of a self-defense claim. I mean, a lot of states, I believe Massachusetts is a good example, or Connecticut, they force you, it's an absurd situation where even in your own home, you must try to escape your own home and flee before you can use lethal force against a lethal force attack. So they strip you of your right to even claim self-defense unless you've tried to run away. And that just took that away. Stand Your Ground says you don't have to try to flee before you can avail yourself of self-defense. You still have to prove that you were in danger of grievous bodily harm or in danger of death, or somebody else was. You still have to prove self-defense, but you don't have this obligation to first show that you could not have run away and escaped.
You mean that, well, first of all, how many states have Stand Your Ground laws?
Good question. I think it's at least, I think about half of them now at least have Stand Your Ground laws.
So let's make an assumption. You're in your house. You know, you're ready to go to bed. All of a sudden, you hear the smashing of a window or something.
Right.
You go downstairs with a gun, maybe a baseball bat, and somebody's in your house. And you're going, you know, what the heck is this? In some cases, are you saying that you do not, as a homeowner, have the right to shoot that person who has broken into your house without getting in trouble yourself?
Well, you can never just shoot someone to protect property. So like when I was teaching concealed carry in Nevada, the standard way we taught it is the guy, you know, you see the guy with your TV in your hands and he's in his hands and he's walking out your front door, you can't use lethal force to stop the theft. You can only use lethal force to defend your life. But the Stand Your Ground laws are meant to preserve your ability to avail yourself of that self-defense claim. So if the guy comes through your door, he's in your kitchen, he's got a knife in his hand, and he's walking towards you. What Stand Your Ground allows you to do is to defend yourself and defend your life without having to first, you know, turn around and try to run, in which case he could stab you in the back or shoot you in the back potentially. So this, it just puts you on an even playing field. Now you just have to show that he was a threat to your life and that you were under reasonable fear of grievous bodily harm or death. You don't have to first show that you had no recourse, no, you could not escape.
We'll take calls with Stuart next hour about this. But, Stuart, this is crazy because who's got the time to determine whether somebody is just in your house, broke into it, and just wants to steal something and run away?
Well, that's,
or kill you.
I mean, if you know, you wake up in some shadow standing over your bed, and you have a handgun within easy range, or you can reach it, and you defend yourself, then the person who judges you, the jury, will look at that and say, okay, in the same circumstances, was his fear reasonable? You know, smashing glass, your wife screaming, some guy's got her on the floor, he's got a knife to her throat, you shoot him, you're probably going to be okay. So it kind of depends on the circumstances whether the jury's going to believe what you did was reasonable. But what was happening, though, is that you weren't even allowed to present the self-defense claim in these states that didn't have standing ground because you had to first prove that you could not escape. They wanted you to run out a window or something, and if you didn't do that, well, sorry, pal, you can't claim self-defense.
Now, with people who have concealed weapon permits, you know, we've always been instructed, boy, you better be right before you shoot the person. And again, that's a very subjective issue too, Stuart, because, you know, if somebody's robbing you, pretending to have a gun, and you have one, I'm not going to think twice. Would you?
Well, but that's the thing. It goes back to reasonable suspicion, reasonable fear. If he's got an object in his pocket, or it's dark, and you think he's got a gun, and it turns out to be a starter pistol, you had a reasonable fear that this was a legitimate threat to your life. And if the jury finds that they would have done the same thing under the reasonable man standard, that a reasonable man would have done the same thing in the same circumstances, then you'll be okay.
I'm in St. Louis right now doing the program. I go back and forth between Los Angeles and St. Louis, and I was here during the Michael Brown episode in Ferguson, Missouri, where the Oath Keepers were also there, too. Give us your perspective on that.
Well, we responded after the fact to the rioting and the arson. We could see pretty clearly that the governor was not going to step in and stop it for political purposes. He was going to let it go on. And this has been the pattern of leftist politicians, is to allow people to riot and burn down their own town. And so we went there, and we weren't the only ones that did this. There were locals. There were young black men standing out in front of liquor stores and convenience stores with shotguns and rifles doing the right thing. So we went there and secured the entire block of buildings, starting with a black-owned bakery, but also, and it shouldn't make a difference what color someone is, but our critics try to claim that we were protecting white businesses, which is complete garbage.
That was
we're
not true. I mean,
minority-owned businesses, actually.
You were protecting businesses, period.
Right, exactly. And also apartments above the businesses. And our logic was, arson is lethal force, and there are people living in apartments above these buildings, so we're going to protect them. And we did. We stood up there with rifles and shotguns, and nobody burned those buildings down.
We're going to talk a lot with Greg about the recent rash of police shootings that have been going on these days, too. Overall, what's your feeling, Stuart, about just the mood of the country with regards to guns, gun control? These horrible episodes, every time there's a school shooting, everybody runs and says, you know, we need to ban guns. And again, it's not the gun who kills, it's the individual. And however that person gets a gun, that's the issue, of course. But what's your perspective on all of that?
Well, the school shooting, the issue is it's a artificial environment. It's a victim disarmament zone. They've created this, you know, like a flypaper kind of thing. They've created this environment where the active shooter, the guy who wants to go out taking a large body toll with him, knows if he goes to the school, he's got disarmed people. So, you know, we put together a panel of our best cops. Greg was on it. And they produce guidelines for schools. And then the basic guidelines are, arm the teachers, those who are willing to be trained properly, let them carry, volunteer parents, and also local military and police veterans, which is exactly what Sheriff Judd does down in Polk County, Florida. He's been doing it for 2 years now, and it works. That's the solution. But the political class in this country doesn't want to listen to logic. They want what they want. I mean, what they want is to disarm the American people.
I would guess, with so many people having handguns and guns, there's almost no way they're going to be able to disarm Americans without really causing a problem.
Well, they're not going to do it. Like I said, half the country, this is part of our life, our livelihood, our way of life, and we see it as a basic fundamental human right. This is not going to happen. So it's going to wind up, you know, I hate to say it, but it'll wind up causing another civil war in this country if they try.
I think
but they can't see that.
I think you're right. And let's hope to God it never happens like that, Stuart.
Yeah, agreed, definitely.
Oath Keepers, of course, the website linked up at coasttocoastam.com, oathkeepers.org. In a moment, Greg McWhirter joins us. He's a police officer and a member of the board of directors. We're going to get his perspective as a law enforcement officer. The next hour, Stuart stays with us for your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Later on in the program tonight, we're going to talk about manifestation and luck with Joseph Gallenberger, author of Liquid Luck, indeed. We're going to come back in a moment with Stuart Rhodes and Greg McWhirter, a police officer, to talk more about the Oath Keepers and other issues as well. Hey, don't forget, August 25th, that's a Saturday, we will have our live stage show in Asheville, North Carolina. There are several handicap seats still available in the front section. And on the sides, on the bottom level, a few seats left, and then the rest are up in the balcony. But come on by, and then we're going to have a meet and greet afterwards. You can get your tickets by going to coasttocoastam.com, click events, and it pops up, or go directly to the theater's website, Diana Wortham Theater. Just go to DW Theater, T-H-E-A-T-R-E.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Stuart Rhodes still with us. Of course, the founder of Oath Keepers. And joining us for the rest of this hour, Greg McWhirter, a member of the board of directors for Oath Keepers, a current serving law enforcement officer, founder of the Western Montana Tactical Training Center. Now, as a sheriff's deputy in Indiana and Montana, he was certified as a law enforcement instructor and SWAT officer. For the Oath Keepers, he helped organize and lead the disaster relief teams that Oath Keepers deployed in Houston after Hurricane Harvey happened. And while doing so, he interacted with federal and local government and other relief volunteers. Back a few years ago, after seeing a need for experienced tactical trainers in the Northwest, he found the Western Montana Tactical Training Center, Greg McWhirter. And thank you for serving, Greg. It's good to have you on the program.
Thanks, George. It's an honor to be on the air with you.
And, Stuart, your mic's still up, so you can chime in anytime you want while we're chatting with Greg. Greg, tell us, what got you to become a police officer?
Years ago, we could go back and say that it's kind of in the family, services in the family. My grandfather fought in Korea. My grandfather on the other side of the family, he was in the military, got many military relatives, and my father was also a sheriff's deputy in Indiana. So it's kind of in the blood.
Whenever you're ready to go to work every day, I mean, is there ever that moment that you say, my God, I may not come home tonight? Does that ever happen?
It has. You know, in Indianapolis, part of my job there with the sheriff's office there was serving felony warrants. So my job every day was looking for the bad guys who didn't want to be found. And so it does cross your mind. You hug your children, you kiss your wife, and you just look forward to seeing them when you come home, and you put that out of your head.
I don't think enough people really appreciate what you folks, you men and women, go through as law enforcement officers. You know, they see the bad things that happen and the aggressive police officers that are on videotape. And then they think that's what's going on at all departments all the time. And that's not true. I mean, 99% of the police officers out there, men and women, are risking their lives and doing what they have to do to protect us. And you are one of them, and I want to thank you again for that. The Stand Your Ground laws, tell me, as a police officer, what do you think of that? I think we've lost Greg. Greg is not there. Let's go to you again, Stuart, while we've got you, because we have lost Greg. I don't know where he is.
Wow, too bad.
But we'll try to get him back. But the police office, how many police officers are members of Oath Keepers?
You know what? Good question. We have, I would say, at least half our membership are the current serving and retired police officers. Quite a large number. On my board right now, I believe we have 8 current or former police officers on board. So over half.
And they're dedicated, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they're some of the most dedicated patriots I know. And Greg is a a good example. He's a very libertarian-minded police officer who cares about the entire Bill of Rights. For example, stop and frisk. You know, he opposed it. I opposed it. I think that's the one thing I definitely disagree with President Trump on, is I don't like New York's stop and frisk rules that violate the Fourth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And Greg's in the same place.
We've got Greg back here with us. So, Greg, let's put you back up, and I'm glad you're with us. You're in the middle of a bad storm, aren't you?
We got a little bit of bad weather here, a little bit of lightning going on here in western Montana.
Okay, well, you be careful. Don't get zapped on us. But I wanted to get your reaction to the Stand Your Ground laws, and as a police officer, what do you think of that?
Well, firstly, you know, I'd like to address them just as an American who happens to be black. We have Stand Your Ground in 33 states, and we need it most of all, you know, in the black community. And looking back on a article that was done by the Tampa Bay Times back in 2013, they did a study on Stand Your Ground, and they found that, you know, there were over 100 Stand Your Ground cases where someone used Stand Your Ground as an affirmative defense. And out of that 100, over 100, there were 24 that were considered justified by African Americans. I mean, it's important for our community. Now, as a police officer, it's even more important that people have the right to defend themselves. People who are living in from the inner cities of Indianapolis to the rural areas of western Montana, the duty to retreat goes against the very core values of what it means to be a person who wants to protect themselves, their family, and their loved ones.
Well, and there's no question about it. You know, like if you're in your car outside somewhere and somebody comes up to your car, not brandishing a gun, and you know you know this is going to be a robbery attempt. I mean, I don't see any reason why you can't floor the car and just take off and be done with it, rather than stay there and get confronted by this individual. But if you're outside in your house or wherever and you're confronted by an individual, I mean, I think you have a right to do whatever you need to do to protect yourself. And, you know, with concealed carry, that's another issue where, you know, the reason for that is for defense.
Absolutely, George. And, you know, in Indiana and Montana, they kind of have a very similar law there where, using the example that you just set of a person in their car, in Indianapolis, I might not be able to floor my car and drive away because of traffic. So I'm obligated to my own interest to defend myself and my life in the terms of a carjacking. And here in Montana, when there's a reasonable apprehension that you're going to be assaulted or you're facing someone's going to use deadly force against you, you have every right to defend yourself or another person when you're faced with the imminent use of unlawful force.
When you stop a car at night, do you get the butterflies knowing that you have to approach that car? It's nighttime. You can barely see the person in the car. What's that like?
Sometimes it could be hair-raising. Then other times it's you're just out there doing your job. You rely on your training. You rely on your years of experience. I've been in law enforcement 15 years. You rely on that experience, and you rely on that gut feeling that something might tell you, okay, something's off with this car. Or maybe, you know, you get a license plate response that tells you this doesn't match the car, and you know, you put yourself on a heightened level of awareness as you approach the car, and then you rely on your training, and most importantly, you rely on your skills to talk to people. I think in my years in law enforcement, being able to talk to people, being able to talk people down even if they're upset, has been the number one tool I've used throughout my career.
Will you always check the plates before you approach the car, the driver?
You try to. You try to. Typically, license plates might be a reason for your stop because they're expired or they don't match the car or the mm-hmm. license plate is stolen or the car is stolen. So you would try to check those plates beforehand.
What has been for you in your career the most harrowing experience, Greg, that you've gone through as a police officer?
Well, we had a incident in Indianapolis where a gentleman had set his house on fire, and he had a felony warrant and didn't want to come out of the house that was on fire. And we got a call that potentially his small child might be in there with him.
Oh, geez.
So the other deputies on my team, we had to mentally prepare ourselves to enter this house with this gentleman who was armed, that was on fire, potentially to rescue this child and see what we could do to save this innocent child. The fortunately for us, the child was found. The child was at the neighbor's house, and unfortunately, the gentleman he passed away from smoke inhalation.
Jeez, was it like a suicide attempt?
Yes, he set the house on fire in an attempt to just kill himself.
Just to kill himself. My gosh. You wonder what goes through people's minds when they do stuff like that. I have always heard that domestic disturbance calls are some of the worst for a police officer. Is that true?
They're the worst because tensions are already high. You approach these situations prepared to be able to separate the parties, talk people down, get things to the point to where you can actually get information about what happened. And if, you know, across the country, domestic violence is an issue, and the guidelines in most states are that if you find probable cause to make an arrest due to a domestic violence incident, you should do so. And they're the types of calls that can go from 0 to 100, and they're the types of calls that can go back from 100 to 0. Every domestic call is unique.
There are cases, Greg, where police officers have been using excessive means in the line of duty beyond what they should. I don't think any police officer wakes up in the morning and says, gosh, I can't wait to go shoot somebody or beat someone up. I don't think an officer does that. But when they're out there on the streets and then they are subjected to using truly excessive violence and means, what happens to the officer to do that? And then, you know, his cohorts are there. They don't seem to stop him. What happens there?
Well, you know, sometimes you're experienced with officers and they're watching it happen when they could or should be stepping in. You know, sometimes they fall victim to the bystander effect themselves, where they can't believe what they're seeing from a coworker who has otherwise been pretty mild-mannered and cool-headed.
Right. Is it like a pack mentality?
Sometimes. And then we have, you know, we have just bad officers, like the officer who murdered Walter Scott, who shot that man in the back who was running away.
And, yes.
I mean, there was absolutely no reason for him to pull that trigger on a man who was unarmed and running away. Yes, there was a confrontation, but at that point, he was not facing deadly force, and he murdered that man, and he was rightfully convicted.
And the guy was running, like you said, he was running away. He wasn't running at the police officer.
Correct. And many agencies, there's a system set up, and you try to weed those officers out. You try to weed them out in the hiring process. You try to weed them out through the academy process. You try to weed those guys out through the field training process, through FTO. And then you try to weed them out through follow-up and subsequent training. And sometimes guys like Officer Slager slip through the cracks.
As a police officer and as a member of Oath Keepers, why are you with the organization? Tell us what that reason is.
Well, many years ago, I was listening to this very program and heard Stuart Rhodes, and it piqued my interest. And being, you know, just another black kid from the inner city, I grew up, and we encountered some bad cops. And as a cop, I wanted to be that cop that was considered a good cop by my community, the community I served. And the values of orders that we will not obey go right along with the values of every law enforcement agency in the country. And respecting people's rights, respecting the Constitution, and operating on a day-to-day basis with integrity. And an organization that represented that really spoke to me, and that's why I joined Oath Keepers.
Greg, do you find that most young people respect police officers, or how do they react to you?
With intrigue, mostly. Most young people, you know, they see it on TV, but they know what you see on TV isn't the whole story, or what you see in the fictional shows isn't really how it's like. So they want to know. And you frequently get ride-along requests. You frequently get the questions, well, what's this like? Have you ever had this happen? And they're just curious. And, you know, through kind of community policing programs and other outreach programs that agencies can do, we can really satisfy that curiosity and really become a part of our communities again.
Most rank-and-file police officers would support concealed carry laws. The police chiefs in most big cities do not. Why is there a difference?
I think it's partially it's political. Most of your police chiefs are appointed, and they are representing the policies of the mayor that appointed them or the city council that confirmed them. And then you see where most sheriffs in the country who are elected by their constituents, they support concealed carry, and they have the exact opposite perspective than those police chiefs. And I think that's partially because of the idea of you're beholden to people and you're a little bit more accountable.
Yeah.
As the elected official, as the sheriff, versus the appointed chief who might survive five or six mayors because he's just played the status quo.
Greg, if you stop someone and all of a sudden that person gets out of his car and starts lunging at you and scuffling with you, and I drive by and I see this, do you as a police officer welcome me to get out of my car to come help you or to keep driving?
Absolutely. I live in a small and serve a small rural community in Montana, and the vast majority of our people here are good people, and they would absolutely come out and help an officer, and they have helped officers many times because I work in a county that's six times the geographic size of Indianapolis, and sometimes there might only be four or five deputies working, and that community that I serve understands the job that we do, and we've done a good job of reaching out to that community.
Just let the officer know that you're there to help him, not the thug, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
All right. Hey, thank you, Greg, for being on the program. Stay safe out there in the streets. We're coming back with Stuart Rhodes and your phone calls. You've heard what we've been talking about. Now you make the call.